All right, we're going to head over to the Zoom line because we're on international overtime here with Canada's greatest export, Mr. Terry Edom. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm all right, thank you. How about yourself?
Hey, not too bad. Are you still writing for the BOE report?
I am, yep.
How's that going around these days?
Well, it's a challenge. Who wants to talk about energy? It's become like religion and politics. It's something you just don't bring up at the meal table. We're over.
You know, I'd like to talk about that as well, but before we talk about that, let's plug your book, The End of the Fossil Fuel Insanity. It's available at...
I got a copy around here somewhere.
Barnes and Noble and
Amazon.
Amazon, other bookstores on the interweb, if not physical bookstores. Mm-hmm. Are you doing the blog anymore, or is time just kind of muscled you out of the blog, so you're just doing the BOE report?
Yeah,
Public Energy Number One is the name of the blog.
Yeah, poor thing. I haven't been on my website for a long time. It's just I just can't keep up with it all. I have a day job and then
a job on top to boot. Yep, I get it. I hear you, man. Well, you know, I did want to talk about that comment you made about how it's a lot like religion and politics, energy is. And I'm starting to agree with you on the whole energy spectrum, to where it's almost if you don't have a certain kind of energy, people don't want to hear about it. And it's a new level of kind of that, modern day leper, cigarette shaming, if you will. And oil and gas went through that, to where if you were an oil and gas worker, man, you were a modern day leper, man. Get back in the alley.
It's a personal affront to people to hear that, hey, you know, we still need oil and gas. And they're like, how can you say that? Because it's true.
Well, let me ask you this question then, because you're in Canada, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of similarities, but I think where our differences come when the oil and gas industry is primarily with how the environment and the land has been approached. Canada is correct me if I'm wrong, but Canada believes all the land is theirs and the people are just kind of using it for the government, right?
In large part, the government owns the resources. Like in most of Alberta, where I'm at, it's owned by the government, and then they lease it out, and we pay a royalty to the government. There are pockets of Canada where it's freehold, and it's the mineral rights are owned by private citizens, but that's not that common. Oddly enough, the bulk of where those freehold rights, we call them, came from was when the Trans-Canada Railway was built in the 1800s, and they granted the company vast mineral rights, which there's a couple entities which still control them, and then some farmers that homesteaded got their rights. But yeah, largely it's the government. So the government sets the rules for everything. So,
and you know, that's happening over here more and more every day. Yeah. The government seems to be setting more of the rules and et cetera, et cetera. But I'll tell you the one thing that we have in common, no matter what, and that's supply chain. This supply chain is a global supply chain. Suez Canal, that ship goes topsy-turvy, disrupts the supply chain. Tanker starts leaking off of Huntington Beach, disrupts the whole supply chain. Hurricane happens in the Gulf, disrupts the whole supply chain. We just had a bridge collapse whether it's cyber attack or whether it's a drunk captain or whether it's old bridge, the bridge still collapsed, and now we're going to have some supply chain issues. Are you impacted? Are you hearing anything up there with this happening?
Yeah, I have a friend in customs that was telling me like what a challenge this is creating for, and it can be the weirdest things that you can be waiting for some shipment of something, and because like you said, it's so integrated, your operations can grind to a halt because of something that happened in Baltimore or Maryland, wherever the bridge was. So, and it can last for a long time because that stuff that used to come out through that coast's ports and down the highways and railways, now it has to come from somewhere else, and the ships have to find another route to get it to another port. And it's very chaotic, and you just don't know where it's going to show up. And And it does sometimes a lot of the repercussions, which you've probably seen this too, they're not really crystal clear. You just want to get something done and you'll hear, well, no, we can't get that for you for weeks or a month or whatever. You may not even know why until you peel back the layers of the onion and you find out they can't get something. So some of it's kind of invisible. But as far as the integration goes, actually Canada's and the US oil and gas markets, natural gas as well, are both extremely integrated. We ship a ton of oil to the US, and the US actually ships a ton to Canada. And same with natural gas, it moves back and forth across the border all the time. So we're really integrated energy-wise.
You work in the natural gas side of things, correct? On your daily,
When it's
day to
needed.
day outside of the media.
We like to give our product away for free. We're such good people. Natural gas is the one product, one commercial or industrial commodity that, which I think is one of the few that's worth less now than it was a quarter century ago. But everybody's just too good at finding it. So, but which is a real boon for North American manufacturers and anyone that owns a warehouse or, yeah, anyone and everyone uses it. So it's an unseen and huge benefit to our economies, both Canada and the US. We're feasting on cheap natural gas and we don't even realize it, the amount of industries that can operate profitably because of it.
Are you getting government intervention with, LNG pauses and lease issues and that sort of thing? That's been one of the issues here in the United States. I just interviewed Kunal Patel from the Dallas Federal Reserve. They just completed their first quarter study, and that popped up quite a bit, was the concern about the number of LNG leases being paused and just that whole side of things. What's going on up there with you guys? Are you guys permitting? Are you drilling? What's happening with the
Well,
natural gas?
compared to what's happening in the US, that would be a dream to have that level of government interference. We have 100 times that up here. It's just they're, I mean, they've been crushing LNG export hopes for 15 years. There was something like 20 big projects that were proposed for the West Coast of Canada, and we're down to one big one and a couple of small ones now. And the one big one is going to actually come in service, knock wood, later this year or next year. So we're thrilled to get one across the goal line. We've had our leadership, and I hate to rag on politicians because I don't like being political, but our prime minister told Germany came to Canada last year, and Germany is a train wreck industrial, and they need energy and they need natural gas, LNG, in the form of LNG, and they're leader came to Canada and said, "Will you please sell us LNG?" And our leader said, "There's no business case to sell you LNG." And anyone in the industry was just stunned that he could say that, because the whole world is developing an LNG industry. And Germany went to Qatar, I think, or however you say it now, and other countries, and they lined up some contracts. There are countries that are happy to find a business case to sell them LNG. And even just the other week, our natural resources minister, who seems to despise natural resources because he doesn't want any development, then it has to be like in line with the IPCC dictates and the UN dictates, has said that Canada has no interest in supporting LNG. The Canadian government doesn't, even though they'll shovel $15 billion to some foreign entity to build a battery plant for electric vehicles in Ontario, which has no hope of being competitive with the rest of the world. Even the US is building, I saw a stat the other day, I can't even, it was a huge number how many battery facilities are being built in the United States, and China's doing the same, and presumably developing countries are. I bet Mexico is going to be, and they have these cost advantages that we just can't match. So we're propping up some wildly unprofitable industries in the name of green progress. That's what we do here in the West. What are you gonna do?
To me, it's remarkable how rank prejudice and energy discrimination can be just so quid pro quo, how it's just so accepted in today's world. It's
And it flies
remarkable.
in the face of reality. It's just like the globe has spent trillions of dollars on renewable energy. And I'm not against renewable energy. I think in their place, solar is great and wind is great. And I'd love to see more nuclear, which I think is the cleanest form of energy. But the fact remains the world still uses something like 80% of their primary energy is met by fossil fuels, which and that's hydrocarbons. I don't even like to use the term fossil fuels, but that's down from like 84% or something in the past decade. So we're spending trillions and we're not really moving the needle. And as far as the rest of the world is concerned, that we're seeing a lot of pushback from developing countries that have had enough of being lectured to. There's a great clip that circulated the web a couple of days ago. If you saw it, the president of Guyana was being interviewed by a BBC typical stiff upper lip, pompous old white dude in a suit, say, lecturing them like, what gives you the right to develop your oil reserves? You're going to put all these emissions into the air. And the president just cut him off and said, you're not lecturing me on climate change. I'm going to lecture you on climate change. And he lit into the guy for like a minute saying, who do you think you are saying this when you benefit from oil every day? And it went viral. I've seen people that posted on Twitter that had 10 million views and almost universally people gave the guy the thumbs up. It's like, it's about time. And not just in developing countries, but in the US and Canada, people were celebrating the guy saying like, it's just so nice to hear a developing country stand up for themselves instead of getting run over. Sorry, I wandered way off topic from your question, huh?
No, that's okay. I was going to ask a follow-up question, but I lost it as I wanted to ask you about the carbon management industry, because I believe you and I have talked about the emerging carbon industry, how the oil and gas companies are particularly leaning towards it, and there's even an ag component to where you can see the Trinity, kind of the triangle of ag, energy, and carbon, start to really work together on a variety of different ways, whether it's biomass or whether it's ethanol or carbon sequestration. There's quite a few examples out there where Exxon and
There is.
BP and Shell and some of the other companies are getting into obviously areas outside of oil and gas. So, two-part question for you. Number one, what's going on in the carbon market up in your neck of the nape? And the second question is more of a curious on your reaction, because I was talking to somebody in Houston the other day, and they mentioned that Vicky, is it Hulub?
Yeah,
Hulub?
I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but yeah, the Oxy thing.
Yeah, Vicky Hulub, we'll say, from CEO of Oxy. They're no longer an oil and gas company because they're no longer Occidental Petroleum. And they're apparently no longer an energy company anymore as Oxy. They're now a carbon management company, which that's extremely progressive, not political progressive, just rhetoric progressive. Because to me, that's where I was 2, 3 years ago when I started seeing the ESG movement, the carbon movement. I'm like, oh, everything's carbon. Gotcha. We're now in the carbon management business, kind of like flooding. We're in the water management business. We're not in flood fights. How are you going to beat water? What are you going to turn it into ice? You're going to turn it into gas? It's going to come back. Water always wins. It always finds its level. So anyway, your reaction on, I don't know if it's true or not, because I just heard it from somebody in Houston that I kind of trust, but Oxy, branding themselves as a carbon management company. And also, what are you hearing up in your neck of the nape with carbon management? I mean, you're a natural gas, so I have no idea if you guys are even doing anything about it, but you are an energy writer, so you kind of,
Well, yeah, no, we're caught in the web. We have a carbon tax here that's applied to any individual or company that burns hydrocarbons or that generates carbon emissions, and you get dinged for that. And it's rising every year, the tax level, and it's getting to be quite a bothersome number. It's really crimping businesses. In the US, at least you give a credit for doing something to reduce carbon emissions. If you can carry on your business as usual, but if you want to do something to reduce carbon emissions, the government will give you a check. And we view that much more beneficially here where it's just turning the screw every year. Just the cost gets higher and higher and higher, and you're forced to spend a bunch of money either way. You have to spend a bunch of money in capital to find ways to reduce carbon usage, or you just pay the tax. So it's quite punitive, and it's just hurting industry. Canada is becoming uncompetitive. But having said that, that's off topic again. The carbon management ideas and business opportunities, and we're very much in sync with the US. I talk to companies across the border all the time that are working on the same things. How do we prevent carbon from getting into the atmosphere? It's really an exciting dynamic field. It's incredible the amount of ingenuity that's being thrown at it, and that I know some very bright people that are trying to solve these nuts. And we and there's companies in the US that are trying to do things like pyrolysis of natural gas combustion. So where natural gas is consumed, if you you can in essence hit it with microwaves, or there's different ways to do it, and that can separate the hydrogen and the carbon, because methane is CH4, one part carbon, four parts hydrogen. And you can separate that before combustion, and then just burn the hydrogen, and then the carbon, instead of being combusted and going into the atmosphere, just is a black powder called carbon black, which can be used in all sorts of manufacturing processes, including tires, and it's a building block for industrial products. So that's things like that are like super exciting, where you could still utilize the existing natural gas system because it's built. There's trillions of dollars invested in it. It works. It distributes natural gas everywhere. And if people can solve this nut about where natural gas is burnt and eliminate the carbon emissions, it's just the biggest win ever. And so things like that are happening across the border, like I said, and they're great to see. I like things like that better than even carbon sequestration, which has all sorts of challenges. It works great in some areas and some it doesn't. It's like geothermal works great in some areas, it doesn't. And there's all of these things have a home. Carbon sequestration can work great as an enhanced oil recovery scheme. You inject the CO2 underground and produce more oil. In Canada, our government won't allow that because they want oil and gas gone. And that kind of gets to the second part of what do I think about all of this stuff. I love the technology. I love the entrepreneurship and the ingenuity that's coming to try and solve these things. When I hear a company declaring themselves to be a carbon management company, I think that they're at kind of a crossroads where they're trying to find a way to justify their existence. So they're painting themselves in the best possible light. And I hear some natural gas companies doing this thing. They make responsible natural gas and these things. And I get it, but I think that they're muddled in what's happening in the world, because the people that they're trying to appease by coming up with these slogans and this marketing, the ones they're trying to appease, like Jennifer Granholm that runs the Department of Energy and all of her people, and the Bill McKibbens of the world, and they want oil and gas dead. They want it gone. They don't want a survivor. They don't want to see you adapt to the new world. They just want it wiped off the face of the earth. So that's you can paint it whatever you put as much lipstick on the pig as you like, and they're still going to call it a pig and want to get rid of it. So I think
And
that's
by the
a
way, I couldn't agree more with you, because if you take a look at the last 15 years and the amount of money they've spent on trying to combat this small problem that was 15 years ago, and now it's completely taken over the planet. And by coming up with new marketing words, that doesn't work. And
Good luck.
yeah, honestly, I mean,
Yeah.
because when you said, responsible natural gas, I'm going, that's all everybody did was
Yeah.
that's all they did was that, hey, we're good stewards and responsible. They tried to, like, out rhetoric people, or out, use vocabulary words,
Yeah.
and it works when you are throwing red meat to the lions. When you go to an industry event and you put a millionaire up on stage, and he starts, revving the crowd, well, of course you're going to get a good response. But look what's happened outside of the industry. I
Right.
mean, it's that example you brought up earlier about how it's like the new politics and what was the other one? Religion.
Religion. Yep.
And now if you say you, well, it's not even oil and gas anymore, it's just energy.
It
People,
is, yeah.
yeah, like even if you are in something that's even close to oil and gas, like I don't even, solar now even gets a bad rap because it's just, it's got, people are tired of it. And I don't know, I look at it, and for me, what I believe, and I still believe this, what the oil and gas industry needs to be doing is standing up and saying, this is what we're doing. This is how good we've been. And I get you're going to keep pointing fingers at us. And we point fingers at us every day, too. That's how we continue to be better. You just keep pointing at problems. And we're not going to reverse it on you because we're not going to play your game. But we're going to keep saving lives. We're going to keep setting the example. And you keep trying to tear us down. That's fine. But we know that people want heat. We know that people want freedom in transportation. We know that people like natural gas to heat their stoves and et cetera, et cetera. To me, it's where they got to switch the presentation from an egocentric to a leadership role. Because when you react and when you get defensive, it just sounds like you're.
Oh yeah, that you're off your back foot, and
Yeah.
that doesn't work. You, yeah, they've been. Well, that's why I wrote my book, was, and I was part of that industry, was the messaging industry 10 years ago, or and they're the industry for so long has just been so bad at it, and they've never really cottoned on to how they have to start addressing this, and so they have to be assertive and start pointing out realities that and it's really not hard to do. Like our. There's 8 billion people walking the earth at the same time only because of hydrocarbons. And that's just irrefutable, whether it's medical equipment or the ability to grow a lot enough food for everyone, which relies on fertilizer, which comes from natural gas or hydrocarbons. The plastics have been revolutionary. Our ability to move around and transport goods and services, our supply chains are all built on that. It's irrefutable, and it's just not that hard to stand up and say we get it, and we can do things better. We should limit methane emissions. Why on earth would we argue against that? We should strive to reduce emissions wherever we can, or reduce even CO2 emissions, and let's sequester what we can economically. But it's this blind rush to obliterate hydrocarbons without really thinking about the good ways to do it, even from an emissions management perspective. It's like if you want to, we're going to war internally and internationally here trying to get rid of hydrocarbons. There are people that's their stated goal. There's the Sierra Club has hundreds of lawyers, and their goal every day is to just make life harder and harder and harder, or sue them. How many lawsuits does Exxon have going on? And that's just their MO. They're paid to do that. They have nothing else to do. If you really wanted to logically reduce emissions and just forget about going to war with someone, well, you could go around the world, replace coal with natural gas. While you're doing that, build nuclear everywhere. While you're doing that, pump a bunch of money into finding the next generation of technology. Stop mandating electric vehicles for people when you don't even have the supply chains to make them. Never mind have the electricity to charge them. Stop doing insane things like farming out your emissions to other countries like Germany is doing or Europe is doing. They're like, hey, look at us, we're reducing our emissions. Well, yes, your industry just shut down. So yeah, well done. You're still consuming everything. It just comes from somewhere else. You haven't solved anything. And these going to war with the hydrocarbon industry isn't solving anything either, clearly. It's been going on for decades now, and what's happened? Nothing. Our global oil consumption goes up every year. Global natural gas consumption is going up. Global coal consumption is still going up. Everybody's been attacking coal forever. Michael Bloomberg of the Bloomberg Empire spends hundreds of millions of dollars to get coal out of the industry or the economy, and it's working in the U.S. to some extent, but the rest of the world is using more and more and more. It's just this madness. I don't know how you stop it, but the one concrete step that the the energy industry could do would be just to start demanding some clarity out there and stop being on their back foot.
Are you guys losing many liberties or freedoms in Canada with this?
Where do I start?
Oh, are
There.
you? I mean, I have no idea because I mean, technically, you're a socialist country, right? Socialism?
Well, technically and factually.
Okay, and factually, well,
Well, they.
technically, you know, we're a capitalist country, but you
Yeah.
know, but in reality, we're more of a socialist or or soft fascist country
Well,
than
no.
anything with the
But
amount of subsidies
one
that
of
we
these
have.
days, you're going to turn on your news and you're going to see me running across your border along with all those other people looking for asylum.
I'm starting to hear people in America that want to run to Mexico. So I mean, they're gonna, they
Maybe I
think
won't
you're,
stop.
yeah.
Enjoy.
I mean, what the heck? I mean, you know, we got all these people from Asia coming through the Mexican border, and we got all these Americans crossing through the other side. It's just it's remarkable. But no, the
Amazing.
reason I bring it up is that when I take a look at, you know, the way things are going and the way that the mandates are really starting to sink globally, as you know, the Paris Accord and the United Nations seem to really have a lot more influence over our countries than our citizens do. And so when I start to see that, you know, that just it just seems like things are going in a certain way. And for Americans, at least from my standpoint, I've been a small business owner my whole life since I was 10 years old. When I was 10 years old, I was a 1099 newspaper carrier. I was a small business at 10 years old. No kidding. And so, all but 3 years of my life, I've been a small business owner. And so what I've seen is I've really seen the fall of capitalism, because the way that the oil industry has really become like agriculture, where the government tells them where to drill and when to drill and all this other stuff, just like in agriculture. You can grow corn over there, you can grow soy here. And what's that? You want to try to grow this? No, we're not going to protect that. And by the way, if we don't bless it, then you don't get crop insurance either. So, you know, they got their ways to really manufacture consent and control the marketplace, if you will. But the bigger picture too is, you know, okay, so we're losing a little bit of our capitalism and a little bit of our freedom from that standpoint. And some of these waters of the United States and the carbon being pumped out, and even some different oil reserves, the states taking over and the government's taking over even on that standpoint. But what we're starting to see more and more is a fear of losing our automobiles, that pretty soon this EV cars that are coming in, you know, some central computer that's going to be able to shut that thing off at any point. And pretty soon we're going to have autonomous, you know, in 2 generations, car ownership will be gone. And, you know, people kind of think that's crazy now, but not really, not really. So.
No, I think that personal carbon budgets are coming. They'll come to Europe first, and Canada will be right behind, I'm sure, and then
Did
they'll.
you just say personal carbon budgets?
Yes.
That's a great phrase. That's a great name, and continue, if you will, on that. That's really insightful.
Yeah, it's being pushed in a lot of circles that want, they're starting to realize that the only way to really reduce emissions is to really reduce our activities, like our travel and whatever else that just limit our scope. And automobiles is one of those things. I think just driving in general is going to be discouraged and made harder and harder. And the concept of a carbon budget is you're going to have a certain allotment every year, and they're selling it to poor people in a sense, because they're going to say, okay, your carbon budget includes 2 international flights per year and 4 domestic ones or whatever. And if you're not going to use them, we'll sell them to a rich guy. And then a rich guy will give the poor guy, yeah, here's $1,000 for your credit so I can fly around the world, because why would they stop? And I mean, the governments don't even go after private jets. They'll try and crimp the emissions on everything else, but private jets and yachts get the exclusion. Then go figure why that is. But so I think that's coming down the pipe if these governments keep getting elected that are pushing the energy or the emissions reduction above all else mandates, the Green New Deal in the U.S., the AOC and Department of Energy people, like that's all they're focused on, it and they've bought into the narrative that our future is at risk if we don't control the weather, and the way we control the weather is to get rid of fossil fuels, as they call them, and they believe nothing else. That's the core tenet of their governance and their belief system, and they just won't do anything other than that. And if the price to human freedom is that you have a carbon budget, I think that's something that, from what I've seen, a lot of these governing elites are more than happy to plug in. One reason it's kind of revolting, but I think one reason they're happy to do that is the people that are pushing these things tend to be the wealthy ones, the wealthy of Western society, university professors and Jeff Bezos and billionaires that can do whatever they want anyways. And so, yeah, of course they're green as can be, because then they're just gonna hover jet around wherever they want to go, and then they'll just buy up everybody's credit, so their lifestyle won't be impacted. There's the stratification society is just going to get worse out of this, because the wealthy will be able to do whatever they want, and the poor are going to be sitting at home because they can't afford to go anywhere, so they've sold all their credits.
To pay for heat and
Yeah.
groceries and other things. And honestly, that's it's going to be the case. And I was when you were talking about the personal carbon budget and the selling the your carbon credits out of the open market, boy, all I could think of is the black carbon market. I don't even know, can you call it black anymore in this woke society?
Probably
What's
not.
the What's the underbelly, that kind of that off market,
Yeah.
the dark, is it maybe? I don't know. But anyway, just that kind of street level of
Yeah. No, it's true.
counterfeit carbon market,
Yeah. Well, and what do you think is going to happen when people get squeezed like that? I'm doing an article about black market economies. Like there's a black market economy developing in Canada, because it's when there's too much regulation, and this is historical precedents all over the place. Italy's had it forever, but when government control becomes too much, when taxation becomes too much, people just start dealing. They just go around it. They just say, "Heck with this! I'm not reporting that income. I worked my butt off. I'm not paying, giving 60% to the government." And these things start developing. And I was looking at Canada's tax system the other day, because it's tax filings, and our regulations are just getting more and more and more and more. We're just getting buried in them here. And technically, the government doesn't even like you bartering with someone else, because you're supposed to declare that. Like if you go do some work for somebody, if you go fix your neighbor's bathroom, you tile the floor because you know how to do it. Like technically, that's income that you're supposed to report, and no one does, but technically you're supposed to. And you're just going to see more and more of this develop. And then
And who do
what
you
happens?
report that to? Who do you report that to?
Well, I suppose you're just self-declare income.
No, I mean, is it the government? We report it to the IRS because
Yeah, no,
we have the same
sorry.
thing.
Yeah, Canada
So
Revenue Agency, we call it up here. Same thing.
Canada, okay, so it's your version of the IRS.
Yeah, we're very.
Okay, so but we have the same thing. Like, in fact, the IRS now, they're cracking down on Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist, and because. Well, they've tried to do garage sales for a long time. They don't like those mom and pops,
No,
man, making money selling old glassware. They got to tax that. So
they don't like it. And so as this thing develops, what's the government's natural reaction? Well, we better hire some more auditors. We better hire
yeah.
some more cops. We have to control this better. And then that just turns the screws on citizens even more. Now, we in the US, we aren't the Soviet Union yet. I think we still have some fight left in us. And I think you will see the pendulum go back and forth. I mean, that's why you have people like Trump that show up on the scene. You just think back to 2015, everybody was incredulous that you got to be kidding. That guy's running for president. And I'm not, but he just was so far out of left field, and he was a reality TV star. And then he surprised everyone, and he got into power. And I think you're going to see more and more of that, like the rise of these right-wing parties, which the media likes to label them as some white supremacist Nazi garbage, but they're coming to power all over the place because people have had enough of government control. So you're seeing the rise of of the right wing in Europe, and in Canada, our prime minister's polling numbers are unbelievably low. Like if you were to call an election today, he would be wiped out. And Trump is making a comeback, which is unbelievable, right? When you look at the number of criminal charges against the guy, he could be governing from a prison cell if he gets elected. And the more charges that get laid against him, the more people get pissed off and say, like, you're trying to politicize the system, or you're trying to use political coercion to silence a legitimate candidate. Anyways, so there will be a backlash against all of this stuff. My and so I do have some faith that things will get better, not just for people like that, but that will people like that will get in power, but we'll have some that at certain point people just say, okay, enough of this nonsense. And we're seeing that pushback in Canada here with the carbon tax, which I mentioned. Every April 1st it goes up, and people are really livid here. A lot of the provinces are asking the federal government to stop the increases, and they're refusing so far. But people say one thing in a poll, they'll say like climate change is a huge concern, but that's because the pollster asks them, are you concerned about more fires and more floods? And they go, oh, yes, I am. And then that makes the headline. Every 78% of Canadians are concerned about climate change because of the way the questions are structured. But then when they ask them, and this is the same in the US, exact same results, ask them, okay, how much are you willing to pay to fight climate change? The majority of people won't even spend $100 a year to do it. And there's a significant portion, I think like over 90% won't spend more than $500 a year, and 10% or 20% won't even spend like $100 or something. So a lot of people just can't afford it. They're like, they're struggling to survive and put food on the table. It's like, oh, and you want me to pay more to help get some CO2 out of the air? Like, get lost. I got to buy groceries, or my kid needs shoes or whatever. And that's the reality for most people. And the people that are making the decisions don't, I just don't think they understand that at all. Like the Democratic progressive side to me has just totally lost touch with the blue collar element. They despise them now. They don't like the rednecks, factory workers. They have their own cliques that buy into their narratives. And so I think that everything is upside down as far as the political spectrum goes. The old labels of left and right really don't mean much anymore. And I think you're having this strat of society which is really suffering. They can't afford rent, they can't afford to buy houses. Young people just have no hope of owning a home. They're lucky to buy a vehicle, and that pressure is building in them. And then they're the ones that are being said, oh, now you have to bear a burden to solve the climate crisis. And some university professor drives by in his Tesla saying, see, it's not that hard. And it's like, well, that doesn't really win too many friends.
One of the things that I find interesting about the personal climate or personal carbon budget is I've been following how they're going to change the next level of the economy, because when you do away from physical money to digital money, you can really pay people whatever without even worrying about it. The only thing you got to worry about is inflation, right? Okay, well, we've gotten off the gold standard, and there's been other standards before, from tulips to, all kinds of different things, emeralds and gold and whatever. And I've been told for the last whatever, we go off the gold standard in the 60s when Nixon was president.
Oh, yeah.
So when we went off the gold standard, we basically went to the military standard, and it was whose military had the power to protect the oil reserves, because
Right.
the oil reserves powered the planet.
That was a
So
global meme. Yep.
that's why the US dollar is the global preferred currency. Now, if we switch off that and you go away from a military to a personal carbon budget where banks are already set up for, what is it? They can take out 10 times this amount based on your debt income or something like that. So the banks are already set up for this type of, you know, this type of activity to where they're not based on, you know, real tangible items. They're just based on debt.
Well, if you think of how a government or a big, like if government is working with big tech, and I believe that they are, just think of what they can triangulate about everything that you do. Like if your Google searches go into a database, they know what you're interested in. They know what you're shopping for. Your credit card bill has all the information on what you actually spend money on. That can go into a database. It's all data. The government knows everything about how much you make. Your passport tells you if you travel international. Mm-hmm. A credit card company can track where you go all over the US or Canada or wherever just by your fuel receipts and lodging and whatever else. They know what kind of food you eat. They, all of this data is there waiting for AI to just scrape it. And so we're so close to that system already. And we talk about we're afraid of a digital currency. Well, we already live in a digital currency. You can start a job now, buy a house, buy a car, and all of the building blocks of life, and never touch a piece of paper. It just doesn't happen anymore. You go through the whole life cycle of home ownership, and you'll never touch a dollar that has anything to do with that. It's all digital anyway. So the digital world exists. It's just kind of, what's it anchored to? And is it, what are the objectives of whoever's controlling it? So I'm not a Bitcoin fan, but I totally understand why people support it. And I think it makes more sense in parts of the world that don't have the same banking system that we do. And I'm frankly surprised that governments allow it to carry on, because it's got to be a threat to that somehow. I always thought that they would step in and quash it, and they're not yet, which is kind of a surprise to me. But maybe
they're doing their own. They're doing their own version.
They're doing their own thing. But maybe that's our hope as free humans, is that there actually is some sort of legitimate alternate currency that governments can't control so easily.
Well, I mean, the part that you're talking about, you know, when you layer in the AI and you start triangulating certain things, it's so far beyond what the average person can think about, to where you literally may not be allowed to go out to dinner because your health points are not enough. And there's too much sodium in the restaurant. So you gotta stay home and eat tofu.
Because you're becoming a health burden to society. So
exactly. That's what I'm saying. They're going to have a health matrix. So if you're going to order pizza, well, forget the double meat, man. You got to get tofu sticks and sprouts on your pizza. I mean, that's where we're going. And people think I'm crazy. Are you kidding me? They're going to say that you get carbon credits so an autonomous car can pick you up.
Yeah, no, I it's totally plausible. We can't afford the way we live, and so they're going to. Well, I don't think we can afford. I mean, we're a debt binging society, or like the U.S. government, or Canada is just as bad, but everyone knows the U.S. statistics. Like your debt is increasing by $1 trillion every 100 days. Like that's unsustainable. Like the way we're living is unsustainable. And then the political zealots believe that our carbon budget is unsustainable. So if you start trying to corral all of that in, that's where you're going to wind up. And for anybody that thinks it's crazy, go back and look at the last days of the COVID thing in China, when they were locked down after everyone else was. This was about a year ago or whatever. And there were incidents in the news where the government was trying to keep everybody locked into their apartments and whatever. And everyone has this digital access on their phone to like go on public transit or do whatever. And they flipped the standard to allow you to travel. I remember seeing it on the news, is people had a little green icon, which meant that they could get on a train or whatever. And then the government unilaterally changed the standard that if you'd been tested, I don't know exactly what it was, but it was something like, if you've been tested 2 weeks ago, you're fine. And then they decided, no, you have to be tested less than a week ago. And so they just changed the standard. And then all these people went to get on a train, and they just were all of a sudden barred from doing so just by one message from the government. And it was shocking, but that's where it's going to go. It's we're everything they want everything to be on our phones, everything digital, and I take the train to work. I buy and they want people to buy a digital transit ticket, and then right there, then I have no control over it anymore. They could do whatever they want with it, right? And they know where I am. They know I'm on the train or I bought a ticket or whatever. So it's yeah, we're just sleepwalking into this. People buy an Alexa or one of these little Google devices or Apple, whatever, and they put it in their home, and it's a little spy sitting there, and you pay for it, and it listens to you all day, and it knows what you're doing, and it knows what you fight about, and you request things of it, and it I can't believe that people actually allow these things into their house, but we pay for them. Whatever.
I
That's
know
how
I'm
you.
with you. I it and my favorite is when people say it's not listening, and then you turn around and
Right.
just actually just say something to the device and it responds back, and you turn to the people and they still it doesn't listen. Oh, okay. Just
Really,
I
yeah.
just showed it to you. And I it's like Einstein or somebody famous like him said, it's easier to split an atom than it is to change a man's mind. And there's a lot of truth behind that. But well, hey, anything you want to plug for the listening audience out there as we kind of wrap up here?
Be happy. Don't watch the news.
Huh.
Go out and smell the roses and enjoy nature.
Yeah, I
If
hear that. But
you're politics or climate change, run away. That's all my only advice.
well, Mr. Terry Edom, BOE report, as well as the author of The End of the Fossil Fuel Insanity. You can pick that up at Barnes and Noble or Amazon, many of the other places. But we'll have links at our website as well. Let's see what we got here. Hang on.